Welcome to the Out of Space podcast, hosted by me, Kathy Lomax, featuring artists from Across Spaces Studios in conversation with writers, critics and art professionals, offering a closer look into what happens behind closed studio doors. Over the next 8 episodes, we will be exploring the theme of care from multiple viewpoints, ranging from artists and parenthood to caring about the community and about the work itself. This series was recorded remotely in order to adhere to social distancing rules, and there may be variations in sound quality. Out of Space, a podcast by Space Studios. This episode of Out of Space's Care series is all about the themes and sources of information that come together to inspire and make an artwork what it is. We're going to be looking at this from the very particular position of copyright and consider how this works in practical terms. Alongside this, there'll be some more conceptual ideas around inspiration, remakes, reproduction, fakes, copies, authenticity and originality that I hope that we'll get to talk about. To discuss this fascinating subject, I'm delighted to welcome two guests who are both involved in the art world in different ways, Hugh Mendes and John Sharples. So welcome, both of you.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello, Kathy and John.
To introduce Hugh first, Hugh Mendes is an artist who lives and works in London, where he has a studio at the Space Triangle building. He studied fine art at Chelsea School of Art, where his teachers included David Hockney and Ewan Newglow. In the early stages of his career, his practice responded to political events. This shifted to paintings of newspaper pages and then onto obituaries. These obituary paintings, which have moved from a focus on political figures to artists, are the work he's best known for today. He's shown extensively, including solo exhibitions in Frankfurt and Los Angeles, with his most recent solo exhibition, Auto Ritratto, The Female Gaze, held at Charlie Smith London in 2020. And on to John Sharples, who's an art collector and art and intellectual property lawyer with Canvas Art Law, a new specialist art law firm aiming to make expert legal advice accessible to a wider range of artists, galleries, art businesses and heritage professionals. One day a week, John is operations director at the Poetry School in London, which sounds fascinating. And between 2013 and 2019, he was chair of the Simmons & Simmons Art Network and was responsible for the firm's celebrated collection of contemporary art, which was displayed across offices in 15 countries. John is currently on the board of artist-led project space and studio provider Block 336, the advisory board of the Block Universe Festival of Performance Art, and was also recently on the board of the Liverpool Biennial. So some really interesting things that both of you have done and lots of stuff that I'm dying to talk about. To start things off, I'd like to ask Hugh if he could tell us a bit more about his work. So in particular, I'm really interested in how you arrived at your paintings of obituaries and in sort of combination with that, where you get your source material from. So, yes. Yeah.
But it's quite a long story. It's been going on
good.
For 20 years. It's sort of the 20th anniversary now of my graduation from my MA,
wow.
Which was actually on 9/11 on that day. It was a funny coincidence. And I had political works in my show, in my MA show, including Osama bin Laden, George Bush. So it's a long story, but it was a weird coincidence. And it sort of adhered me to working with newspapers and political stories, obviously, because it was such a monumental event.
So was that picked up upon by the press?
Yeah.
You know, did that make a bit of a stir?
It did a bit. I mean, I had a solo show 6 weeks later of works that I made from the newspapers that I collected for a week after 9/11. I just collected all the papers for a week and then went through all the images and then made about 20 paintings. That was my first solo show. It really wasn't picked up on until I did a 10-year anniversary show at Kenny Schachter's gallery at Hoxton Square 10 years ago, so like halfway. That was picked up on. I did a radio BBC interview and a full page article in The Independent. And I had a relationship with The Independent. I mean, I'm supposed to be talking about the obituaries. The obituaries came 2 years later, which were things like Osama bin Laden. That was 10 years later. Saddam Hussein. I started actually with Princess Margaret. She was the first obituary. And I juxtaposed her with Spike Milligan. They were a bit of a double act in my own mind.
And I think they did know each other, didn't
yeah,
they?
Yeah, yeah, there was some stories there. So yeah. I was picking up... The thing I picked up on from The Independent was the editor of obituaries in The Independent was a guy called James Ferguson. He started using odd images, I thought, for the obituaries. Derogatory images even, or comical images, which was rather radical, I felt. And I wrote to The Independent. I got an email back from James Ferguson saying, I'm glad you like my work. That started that relationship. I had a dialogue with him. When he retired, his workers, his co-workers from the obituary department at The Independent came to my studio and bought one of the paintings to give to him as a retirement present. So it was a very nice thing that happened. When The Independent was sold to the Russians and sort of disappeared, the whole team went from The Independent to The Guardian, and I kind of went with them. And that was current until relatively recently, when again The Guardian was redesigned and redesigned again and shrunk and sort of disappeared, and the fonts and typography all changed in a way that I didn't want to work with it anymore. I couldn't do it. So I started making up my own fake Guardian obituaries.
In the style of
using the old font, which by then I could just reproduce at will in paint. So anyway, so then also I started using other images, not the images as they appeared in the newspapers. I started trawling through the internet and finding other images that I thought were better. In fact, it was Diane Gower was the main person at The Guardian, and she said, oh, you should be our picture editor, which of course was a joke really, but... And they would actually go through images and think, I wonder if you would like this image. I mean, again, it was a bit of a joke, but it was a nice dialogue to have with them. Anyway, I started using different images. The more significant thing was when I started using self-portraits of artists. It started with Lucian Freud's obituary, 2016. And I used a self-portrait instead of the image, a photograph of him that they used in the paper. Once I'd done that, I realised, in fact, all the artists of history had done self-portraits. So I could use anything. So it opened up this huge vista of... I was already making fake obituaries in the style of, and then I was using different images. And then when I used a self-portrait of the image rather than a photograph, it opened up 500 years of history of self-portraits. And that's amazing. That's what I've been doing for the last... 4 years, 5 years now since Lucian Freud. So in the last two shows I had in London were just based in self-portraits. The one you mentioned, there was Autoritratto and then Autoritratto 2, which was just women. Actually, the first one was just men with one woman, and I reversed it for the next one with all women with one token man. But that was Marcel Duchamp in drag as Rose Selavy. So, you know, there's more there, but that's the basic... some bones of it anyway.
Yeah, it's interesting that this kind of something that might seem like quite a restrictive framework that you've built actually opens up to have so much potential, and by using and making these fake obituaries and using self-portraits, you're creating a kind of portal, it seems, you know, in the style of The Guardian between now and then. Which is
really
interesting.
Rembrandt's obituary as it might have appeared in The Guardian. I've done several Rembrandt obituaries because he had so many self-portraits and so many fantastic things to work with. So,
and does the text of all these obituaries say different things?
No, it just says Rembrandt. I tended, again, that's another thing that happened, I tended to reduce the text, especially with the obituaries. Sometimes they used to have columns of fake text. You know, the Dutch were using it in the 17th century. They would have just smudgy lines to represent text when they were doing trompe l'oeil, illusionistic, still life, you know, of notes and things stuck on a wall. It's the same. I can't show you because we're on a radio. But
we're only talking.
I've got examples all over my studio. But anyway.
We'll put some images on the website so people can check them out. And I guess that maybe it's important to describe what the actual paintings look like. So they are oil paintings, aren't they?
Yes.
On canvas.
Yes. So I make up the canvases. They're actually super high grade, super fine linen. So it's a very smooth surface to work on. So I work with tiny brushes and
what
lenses.
Sort of size do they tend to be?
Well, they're trompe l'oeil, so they look like pieces of newspaper stuck on a canvas.
Right. So the same size as a newspaper. Yeah.
I had experimented with doing big, you know, like 2 meter by 3 meter type things, blowing them up, like people like Andy Warhol, Richter, all kinds of people have done that sort of thing in the past. But I found that the more successful ones were the trompe l'oeil, illusionistic ones that looked like newspaper stuck on a canvas, because I also represent the shadow, like it's a clipping stuck on a wall. So if you walk into any artist studio, you'll see postcards stuck on a wall, newspaper clippings, that kind of thing. Like I say, the Dutch were doing it in the 17th century. And so I represent the blue tack, even like the shadow, and it's an illusionistic trompe l'oeil thing.
Yeah.
So
that's fantastic. Thank you. That's given a really good picture, I think, of what you do. So, yeah, I'd like to talk to you, John, now. I know that alongside being a lawyer, you are a collector. And I wonder if you could tell us a bit more about your interest in art, and I guess in particular your connection with grassroots art making, art organisations, and also the kind of work you collect. Just give us a bit of a flavour about your connection to the art world.
Yeah, so before I ever started collecting on my own account, I collected for that corporate collection you mentioned earlier on, the contemporary art collection of Simmons and Simmons. And that was an interesting collection in that it started in the very late 80s, early 90s, with quite a modest budget, but was very much in the right place at the right time in terms of London becoming the centre of the art world, the emergence of the YBAs. And what was interesting is by the time the collection was in my care, around 2013, 2014, the budget hadn't changed at all in the intervening 25 years, but the art world and the art market had changed enormously. Mm. So there was just a practical reality, which was that the price point of where that collection acquired was, you know, a few thousand pounds. And in today's art market, that means you're shopping at degree shows and work by recent graduate artists. So I became a bit of a fixture on all the artist degree shows. And it's an incredibly addictive thing to be doing. And so as soon as I had any disposable income of my own, I was also looking at, you know, buying one for the collection and one for myself. And I would say pound for pound, I've probably spent as much of my disposable income on art as anybody in the last 5 years. 5, 6, 7 years. And it's just such an interesting level at which to be buying, because, you know, at that point in an artist's career, they really notice who's buying from them. It's that critical point, that boundary between deciding whether or not you're even going to make a career of this or do something else. And there just is that you do have a different relationship with successful artists, or however you define success. If you were there at the beginning, you know, before they were famous and before they were celebrated, that's one of the cliches, is that artists do remember those who were there before they were famous. So there's no particular rubric relating to how I collect. It's just, what can I afford at any given time? When have I paid off installments on something? that's the only thing that determines the timing. I'm a particular lover of painting, and it's and 2D works, so drawing and some photography. Again, that was all the collecting I did for the law firm was 2D, just because of the nature of the working spaces we had. It was difficult to show digital work, or it was difficult to show sculpture. But I've branched out a bit. It's just an exciting point in the market at which to be buying, and you just get a really good sense of what is being made now today and what the trends in that are.
That's really interesting, and And I think you've kind of identified a really important thing, you know, looking at artists who are working at the beginning of their careers and the way that you can kind of really make a difference, I think is, you know, such an interesting point. And it's such a great way to put together a really great collection of work as well. I mean, I think more people should do it. I always think people need to be encouraged to buy work a lot more. I think lots of people don't really realise that they can do it and the artists would love them to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. In the UK, something that I think about a lot is why do the British buy so little work by living artists, you know, compared to especially my colleagues on the continent. You know, young professionals in Italy or in Belgium or in Germany, they buy art by living artists. And it's partly about the different ways in which taste plays a role socially in different cultures and different countries. I think a theory that I've floated several times, so I'll try it on you as well, is in the UK, the obsession is with owning your house, owning the bricks and mortar. Whereas in those cultures where it's more of a rental culture, the stamp of ownership on your living conditions comes with the aesthetic stamp you put.
Right.
And so I've acted for the rights owners for high-end furniture. So, you know, design furniture companies like Vitra or people who produce the Eames chairs. And they just say that the UK to them is just not an important market because even pretty wealthy people here buy IKEA furniture. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but they don't pride themselves in having nice items and art in their houses. And that's just very different. I mean, if I go to my colleagues' houses, as I say, in Italy, say, it's incredibly important to them that if they have their colleagues and friends around for dinner, that they should be impressed by whatever art they have on the wall. And that just culturally isn't something that's true in the UK. So it's a mystery.
No, that's interesting. But maybe there's also here, there's always been a thing about antiques. So kind of the traditionally the sign of good taste, you know, a very wealthy person would have amazing antique furniture and probably antique or, you know, paintings by dead artists in their home. And there hasn't been quite such an interest in contemporary things. Maybe that's the fault of history somehow or something. I don't know.
Can I add something to that?
Yeah, please.
From my own experience, I lived in the States for 7 years in California. Every house you'd go into, there would be original art on the walls. Just ordinary people's houses. It was very noticeable how that was the case, and it isn't the case here, exactly as you're saying. I'd also say most of my collectors are either in the States or in Europe, especially Germany, Switzerland, France, Italy, Spain. Well, you know, I have got collectors in this country, but they're very much in the minority. It is interesting.
And that has such implications for the dynamic of seeking collectors and addressing collectors here, because it's such a rarefied small group of very influential, wealthy people here. Whereas you get the impression when you're in Germany or Belgium that you know, the number of collectors per head is really quite high, and it's a much more lively collecting culture, especially at lower price points. And we, you know, we talk endlessly about the middle dropping out of the market of the gallery system in the UK, but you know, the middle, it thrives in places like Germany, Switzerland.
So, yeah, luckily we have access to that market, mainly through art fairs, but obviously that's all shifting at the moment because Brexit. All the art fairs have been online.
And also the whole Brexit thing maybe might.
That's a whole other issue, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very familiar with these problems from running a small gallery where we, you know, would have loved to have sold more work. And like you say, there were just so few collectors. I think it was noticeable when we did do, occasionally when we did do a really big sort of salon hang type show, when work was particularly lower priced, then we would find more people would, you know, be tempted to buy something. And I just think if people start to buy original art, then that might hopefully lead on to more. So I was always really keen to get as many people buying as possible.
Yeah, I hope so too. And it's in the artist support pledge phenomenon has been interesting recently because it's shown that there is a huge appetite to buy at low prices. And hopefully it will be a gateway drug for a lot of people.
Yeah.
and it is the thing that overcomes a certain amount of British cynicism. Like, I think there's a particularly cultural thing here whereby people are cynical about what that value represents, and they don't want to be ripped off. And so you'd almost rather have nothing than run a small risk of being ripped off by someone,
or to look foolish. I think that's a big worry.
Exactly. And so
people go, "Oh, have you bought that? Your taste."
Lawyers
you know.
And bankers and professionals here are just incredibly sceptical about paying even quite small sums, like work for more than £1,000. It's just like very difficult to tell them what that represents.
Mm. Fascinating. I guess we're going off our main subject a little bit, but that's worthy of a whole podcast on its own, I think, for sure. So my own practice involves using existing imagery, getting back to this kind of idea of working with found images and that kind of idea. So notably, I look at images from films, but also fashion magazines and advertising. And I kind of see it as a way, my rationale is that I see it as a way of processing the imagery that I'm drawn to. So I reconfigure it and change it around a bit. Now, I know, Hugh, obviously you also work with existing imagery, yes. Borrowed imagery, maybe we could call it, and you reconfigure it and put it in a different context. And your paintings, as we've discussed, are very meticulous and detailed. Have you ever had any issues with copyright? I know you've described your close relationship with the newspapers, which is really interesting. Mm. But has there been anything that's ever come up?
Not really. Once recently, I was asked to remove an image from Instagram from an estate, and where it was a self-portrait that was based on, it was a photographic self-portrait. I think that was significant. And I just removed it. That was the end of that story. And that's the only instance I've ever had. Mostly when I have been contacted, it's been appreciative. People saying, thank you so much for painting that beautiful painting of my dead husband. Or, that was in the case of David Hemmings when he died. His wife contacted me through the gallery. And that's all I've had really is, I think partly because they are very respectful. But I'm not doing anything damaging or derogatory, or I'm not trying to steal anything from anybody really, or I'm making these memorial pieces, and on the whole people seem to appreciate them. I have had various discussions, even right at the outset. I met a guy from Associated Press that was talking in the context of newspapers. He said it was not a problem at all. I was making original paintings, I was reconfiguring, changing everything really, and he didn't think it was a problem. And that's roughly been the case when I have had discussions. I think it has changed more recently, and John will be very familiar with more recent developments in copyright issues. I'm sort of aware of it. I noticed, John, I looked you up and I saw the interview you had with the lawyer from New York and the Richard Prince case, which we're all very familiar with, and also the Luke Toymans. I'm also reminded of Sturtevant, who I painted her self-portrait. And of course, Sturtevant famously copied exact copies of Warhol's, and when Warhol was asked about it, he said it was fine with him, she was better at it than he was.
I've written response. Down a whole kind of section about Sturtevant because I love her. She's and that dialogue with Warhol is so great. It's so typically him, being the kind of prankster that he is and wanting to mix everything up.
Can I just ask you quickly, Hugh, that one complaint you had, how recently deceased was the person involved?
Oh, not recent.
Not recent. Because it's interesting, you sometimes have more difficulties with an estate, especially of someone who has recently passed away. But anyway, sorry.
The only interactions I've had with estates of recently deceased have been appreciative through the galleries, that kind of thing.
I was just going to ask you, John, really, I also watched your broadcast for Block 336 about the copyright issues, which I thought was really great, where you talked about Richard Prince. And I loved the whole Haroon Misra situation of kind of turning things on their head by in effect highlighting fake Louis Vuitton things was great. But I just wondered if you could just talk to us a little bit more about some particular art-related copyright issues that that you've come across recently or that are particularly interesting.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm so pleased by this entire topic, and that people like you are, well, we can humour each other with the things, the esoteric things we're interested in. I mean, my obsession is fair use and the extent to which artists are free to use the images of the world. You know, if we accept that images are perhaps the building blocks of the world more than any other substance or unit of meaning, then if artists are going to be free to comment on the world, then they have to use the world's images. You've mentioned a couple of the cases over the years that I've been really closely interested in. So, you know, Luke Toymans, for example, lost that case in 2015, having painted an image where his source material was a photograph of a politician. Not a press photograph, but it was a kind of editorial photograph, a Sunday supplement type editorial. And the way that photograph was composed is it clearly had, although it was news, it had some art ambitions in the way it was composed. It wasn't just a conventional press shot. And Toymans lost, he was sued for copyright infringement and lost. And it's so interesting to me how unsophisticated we are collectively in talking about that episode, because what you would see in the newspapers is headlines saying Toymans convicted of plagiarism, which is a totally unrealistic and disproportionate response to someone narrowly falling the wrong side of the line when employing a fair use defense, or in Europe, a fair dealing defense. So fair use is something that interests me a lot, and the conditions can change quite quickly in a short space of time in terms of what people think is fair. So I've recently been helping an artist who 10 years ago was using kind of memes and user-generated content at a time when there was no market practice of licensing that type of content. But in the intervening period, there is now an active licensing market for that stuff. And so the idea of what is part of the commons and what is a free-for-all can change over time. The power dynamic is very important. You know, if a successful artist is seen to be borrowing downwards and free riding on a creator that's significantly less powerful or wealthy, then that is an important factor in how people judge the fairness of the situation. You know, in the Toymans case, it wasn't irrelevant that it was a female photographer who, you know, was by no means rich. And Toymans himself is a rich, powerful white man whose work sells for seven-figure sums. So the recurring commentary was, well, couldn't he just have paid her a license? You know, why does he have to skulk around taking this stuff without asking? He's powerful and could pay. But to which my response is, well, if you have to go cap in hand asking for permission, that completely changes the nature of the activity and the freedom of the artist to treat those found images as found objects. So licensing doesn't work. Anyway, this is an incredibly rambling, unstructured answer to the question you've asked me, but...
No, it's perfect. It's perfect.
That last point I thought was particularly interesting. It ceases to become a found object.
Something I say a lot is that if an artist really believes in what they're doing, they have an innate sense of whether something is additive and fair, without necessarily being able to explain the principles of why that is. And so, therefore, it's generally easier to do something and do it well and beg for forgiveness than it is to ask for permission in advance. And a classic example of that is back in 2012, the Tate acquired The Clock by Christian Marclay, which is 24 hours of footage taken from the history of cinema mainly. So short clips from many, many, many hundreds and thousands of films. And the advice the Tate received at the time was, well, this is clear copyright infringement, but in each case, the infringement is only small. You probably won't get sued, so you should crack on and take the risk, because this is obviously a work that adds to culture and is a fair use of that material. But legally, if any one of those copyright owners had taken the case at the time, they probably would have won. Now, the law has changed slightly since. In 2014, we had a raft of new copyright exceptions come into English law, which probably now put the matter beyond doubt. But
Put the matter beyond doubt that it's okay.
Yeah. But at the time when Tate acquired it, it definitely wasn't beyond doubt. And actually, it was probably clearly the other side of the line. But because it didn't damage the economic interests of any of the rights owners, it was thought that it was practically unlikely that any of them would take up the matter, and that proved to be true.
Mm. I was going to ask about that, John, whether one can do it retrospectively. You know, I know the law's changed now, so it's slightly different, but could you look back at, like, say an artist isn't very successful when they made this piece of work. 10, 20 years later, they become very successful. The work's value goes up massively. And then the person comes along and says, right, I'm going to sue you for copyright now because I want the money.
Yeah, and in practice, that's exactly the few cases we have. That is the dynamic, because there's a huge pot of gold to aim for. And so that's why very few of these things ever make it to court and ever get argued. And we have very few decisions. So the reason it remains a grey area is because so few cases are fought to a conclusion. But the ones that are tend to involve names like Jeff Koons, Richard Prince, Luke Toymans, where there's a significant sum of money to aim for at the end.
That's one of the things I've been told, that if you ever make a lot of money, or if those paintings go up in value, that's when the people try it. They'll try it on. That's how it was put to me. They'll try it on. Not that they'll have a case necessarily, but
that's slightly worrying, isn't it? I'm just thinking about all my work. That's really, I'd never really considered that. I mean, I know a little bit about fair use because I publish a couple of magazines, and when we started off, we always have articles about films. And when we started off, we used to contact studios and press agents and try to get permission to use images from the films. And it was such hard work. You could never find the right person. They never got back to you. And then I read something which said, you know, there's this thing called fair use, and as long as you're using the image to illustrate a kind of piece of academic writing or to make a point, then it's absolutely fine. So since then, I've just, you know, used screenshots and got all my own images together for about films to use, and I've never had any problems.
And something people comment on all the time is that although copyright is there notionally to protect artists and to be something that gives artists a livelihood, it can often harm artists as well. If it becomes a barrier to dissemination of work or academic study, it's definitely in an art historical context. Publishers are constantly talking about image licensing fees, making the whole thing prohibitive. When I ran that collection at Simmons & Simmons, there's no copyright exception for showing images of the physical objects you own. And so despite the fact that my aim was to put images online on a collection website, not for any kind of advertising purpose, but simply to show the world what we had, so that if they wanted to ask to come and see it, they could, or if they wanted to borrow it for a museum show, they could, or if they wanted to write about it. But you have to go one by one and get a license from the artist or the relevant collecting society to do that. And that it seems to be a shame. It's not sure if there's an easy solution. If I were writing copyright law again from scratch, I think I would write an exception for museums and collections so that they can show images of the physical objects they own. There's an exception in copyright law for advertising works that are for sale. So auction houses don't have to get licenses to show images of the things that they're selling, because there is this specific exception that relates to their activity. And I think there could be a specific exception for collections. Yeah. But my wish list is long when it comes to that sort of thing.
It does seem to be all skewed in the wrong way, doesn't it? Because there seems to me there is an issue with originality in terms of maybe one artist copying another artist's work, which is something which I've come across a little bit more when, you know, occasionally things happen and it's a little bit uncomfortable. And but it would be so hard to pin that down, I think, and to actually speak to that person and say, look, you know, you're making work that looks exactly like mine and you're using all my themes. So...
Yeah, but that's why it's so important that we get to a state where we can collectively talk about this in quite a nuanced and precise way. Because if we're indiscriminately using words like stealing, citation, influence, inspiration, homage, sampling, appropriation, you know, borrowing, imitation, if we don't use those words very carefully and specifically, then we are denying ourselves the correct toolkit to analyze those things. And what I would say is I've definitely encountered examples of one artist producing something that looks almost identical to the work of another, and I have in a more than one occasion convinced myself that it's a complete coincidence and the artists have arrived at the same place independently. And that's an incredibly difficult thing to deal with. If as an artist you recognize your work in someone else's work, and the way you feel so connected to your own work as if it's an indivisible part of your own personality and mind, it's almost impossible to accept that it could have happened by coincidence. And so quite often I find myself in the role of counselor more than, you know, legal advice.
Yeah, and of course we, you know, it's very healthy to be influenced by other people. We, you know, that's what we're told anyway, that you know, you look at other people's work, you might take a little bit from here, a little bit from
that's
there.
That's what artists have always done, isn't
that's
it?
That's what that we've always done. Yes.
We always have to. We are the result of art history.
Yeah. So it's just when it steps over, but I completely take the point that two artists may well have arrived at exactly the same thing. And especially, you know, if you are working from material which already exists and then someone else is doing that as well, you can't really say, you know, that's my material that already exists that I'm working from. So that does become quite tricky. I wonder, do you think that artists should be more aware? I mean, you've already said that there needs to be more precise use of all these terms and kind of more dialogue about it. But I'm thinking in terms of education. Do you think that art schools should run kind of classes in copyright or legal issues that artists might encounter? And do students tend to know anything about it or be at all interested in it? I know that you teach, Hugh, so you've got something to say about
I
that.
Do
and John,
teach.
What?
Yeah,
yeah
no,
John.
Hugh, why don't you?
Well,
take,
I was going to say.
First?
And John, you're probably familiar with the college where I teach at City and Guilds in Kennington, because Block 336 is closely associated with that place.
Yeah, I've had many
groups. For instance, and I'm sure you've been along to the shows and so forth.
Yeah.
But we run a programme of professional practice, seminars, talks and so forth, including legal, you know, expertise and so forth. So it is built into the programme. The funny thing is, of course, that all the students are very much encouraged to reference their work in terms of art history and contemporary practice. So they're encouraged to look constantly to, you know, to find source material into the history of art and contemporary practice. And so, you know, that they have to do that. They're told to do it. They're told to look, you know, steal everything you can from wherever you can get it. Everything that's useful, that's going to be inspiring or what, you know, whatever. You know, that's what I say, like, we're all referencing art history and we're all referencing what's going on around us, the contemporary world we live in, and so we have to do that. So on the whole, that's what we encourage students to do, and I'm not involved in the professional practice seminars, so I don't know, but we do get people in to talk about these issues, and so students are made aware of those things and they are taught, you know, about the Richard Prince case or the Toymans case or whatever. But they're also taught how Picasso said, I don't borrow, I steal. I don't seek, I find. And Francis Bacon saying, you know, there are no rules. It's not cricket. Art, you just do whatever you want. Get on with it. You know, be radical. Push the boundaries, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a double-edged, it's kind of like a double-edged sword, and be cavalier on the whole if you can. And you'll probably get away with it if you're a student.
Well, that's partly what chimes with my advice for, if you're doing something and doing it well, begging for forgiveness rather than asking for permission. Yeah, I've spoken on loads of those professional development elements of art school courses. In fact, Sitting Guilds, I used to show the students around the collection at Simmons & Simmons and talk a bit about some of these issues in the margins. But I've gone to several of the other schools as well. I mean, I wouldn't want to overdo it. You wouldn't want to have artists paralyzed by thinking about these issues. But something that I encounter all the time is that artists are paralyzed by the thought that they don't know what they don't know. And actually, they're more conservative and cautious than they ought to be. You know, if the situation were that artists were recklessly repurposing material left, right and center and constantly getting into hot water because of it, then that would be something. But actually, it's the complete opposite. Artists are very nervous about using other copyright material.
That's so interesting. So a bit more education for some artists might actually be a very good thing in terms of freeing them up a bit from these worries.
Think so, and especially artists, especially designers and you know, fashion designers. I sometimes go and do lectures at London College of Fashion, and I'm actually shocked by how little of this that they do. Because if you're a fashion designer, you are going out into the world to sell or license intellectual property for a living, and if you can't describe what it is that you own or what it is that you're entitled to, then you're in an incredibly vulnerable position, because more sophisticated operators are constantly swirling around that environment. And, you know, you're very vulnerable if you can't even conduct the basic conversation about, you know, whether you assign ownership or give a limited license. You know, those are the very basics that I think art students and designers should be equipped with.
Actually, that does lead me quite nicely onto one of the things I wanted to ask you, John, which is, what is intellectual property? Could you give us a little summary?
Intellectual property is the umbrella term that refers to a number of rights that are given to artists, inventors, and designers. So, you know, the main kinds of intellectual property rights are copyrights, trademarks, patents, and designs. And again, even in quite sophisticated press, those terms are used interchangeably and incorrectly in a way that's very unhelpful. So we talk about copywriting a name, and so there are lots of very basic misconceptions out there about whether or not you should register copyright or whether you can patent an idea and all these things. And so I do think everyone would benefit from a kind of basic grounding in those concepts. There's a cultural distinction depending on where you are about whether the focus is on those rights as economic rights, you know, the right to have an economic monopoly and what it is you're doing, or whether really the core of the right is a moral right and to do with the fact that your work is your identity and your personality, and it should be protected on that basis because it's an essential part of the human self. Now, if we talk about the two extremes of those paradigms, so, you know, in the US, it will not surprise you at all to hear that they have a very economic view of these things. And that's why they have a broader sense of fair use, which is that if you're not harming someone else's economic interest, you're more or less good to go. Whereas in France, it couldn't, you know, it's very different. And it is about the art as being a product of the artist's tortured soul. And you know, the considerations are far more to do with moral rights than the business of having economic monopolies. And so it's some of the most interesting cases I deal with are mediating cases between, let's say, an American artist on one side and a French rights owner on the other side. So, you know, if there's an American appropriation artist using material by a French artist, that's an incredibly difficult thing to address because they both start with such differing cultural and philosophical expectations.
That does clash things, doesn't it, together. That's great. Thank you, John, for giving us that little kind of brief about intellectual property. It's really useful. I guess we're kind of getting towards the end of our time. I was just thinking about a really brilliant exhibition I saw at the Prada Foundation in Milan. I don't know if either of you have heard of it, in 2016, called L'Image Volée, curated by Thomas Demand, which was described as an opportunity to reflect on how each creative act can be born from pre-existing images. And it had some of Sturtevant's Warhol Marilyns in it. And it had things like paintings that were hanging in Hitler's apartment that had been destroyed by liberating American soldiers, and I don't know, loads of really good stuff. But I mean, it seems to be a subject, this idea of working with pre-existing images and changing things and reworking them. I don't want to use too many of those terms and mix them all up. I'm aware of being more precise. It seems to be something that continues to be of interest. I also think about De Chirico, who used to remake some of his earlier paintings because the earlier paintings were the ones that everyone wanted to buy and they didn't like his later paintings. So he used to, in effect, fake his own earlier works, which I think is wonderful. And I love all those stories where all of this kind of gets mixed up and it's really mischievous and playful. So it's kind of a never-ending source of creative inspiration to me.
Quite.
Mixing these things up and, stealing images and things.
I think we're often collectively unrealistic about what originality is and actually what imagination is. I do think imagination is probably best thought of as a reordering of experience, be it consciously or subconsciously. And when you rather than a bolt from the blue, a spark from nowhere. And definitely in the West, we have the notion of originality on such a pedestal. Like, it's the entire gateway to the copyright system. Like, originality is the threshold that gets you protection within the copyright system. And so the entire system finds it difficult to deal with remixing or combining things or recontextualizing, because we start from this position of thinking that originality is everything. And we don't show a high degree of humility about how different our culture is to some other cultures in this regard, where copying or a tradition being handed down is a much more central part of artistic tradition than constantly finding the next new thing.
It's an issue in the music industry as well, isn't it, which we haven't really touched on. I'm very aware of, like, sampling and so forth, and then people coincidentally coming up with the same guitar riff or something, you know, and there have been famous cases with that going on as well. But it's clearly what we do, and it's interesting what you say about imagination, where that comes from, and where, you know, combining images in your head and a new thing happens. And there's an irony in what I've been doing recently, where I've been remaking other people's self-portraits, which is a fascinating thing to have been doing. I mean, it's absolutely an extraordinary thing to try and do, to pick up completely different styles from different artists and remake their self-portraits, their image, how they saw themselves. So I'm copying as exactly as I can, but at the same time I'm coming up with something completely original that nobody's painted an obituary of Rembrandt, as far as I know, ever. It's a completely original concept. So, but it's, you know, it's imbued with exact copying. Well, it's not exact, because mine's only like 18 inches, whereas the original was like several feet, whatever. It's not even a copy. You know, people used to go into the National Gallery and just sit there with an easel and copy as exactly as they could.
Do they not do that anymore?
I don't think so. I haven't seen it for many years, but it used to be such a fixture, especially at the National Gallery. That's how you learn to be a painter. Yeah. And we still teach people, like, we take them to the National Gallery and say, look, this is how you paint. You know, you look at a Velasquez, look at that brush mark, look at this, look, try it. You know, copying from the masters was always the tradition. That's the problem with Rembrandt, again, is because that's how he taught all his students. In his studio, they had to copy his paintings. And now they can't tell which is a Rembrandt and which is copied by one of his students, because it's from the same time, from the same place. It can be identified, you know, chemically and so forth, coming from that studio at that time. But Nobody knows who painted it.
That sounds like a subject for that Fake or Fortune program, which I love.
They keep changing their minds, don't they? So, well, this one was a fake and that was the real one, and then they switched them over.
And that's primetime TV. It's amazing how many millions of people tune into Fake or Fortune for provenance research. Who knew? But it's absolutely compelling.
It is really compelling. And just the idea that somebody can just decide if a painting's worth, you know, a million or, you know, 100 quid is just, I think, such a strange concept that people love it. So I guess to end with, it would be really nice to know what you're both up to at this precise moment in time. So let's start with John. What are you working on right now? Is there anything you can tell us about what's going on at Block 336? Anything?
Yeah, well, so the very exciting thing for me professionally at the moment is that I'm just starting to work more or less full time with a new startup specialist art law firm that you mentioned at the top of the show. Because one of the main flaws with our system of justice is that it's a rich man's system, and it's the good advice is inaccessible to majority of the people who need it. And that is true in most sectors, and it's definitely true in the art sector. And so I'm very pleased to be part of this new firm with people who share my values, who want to make the best art advice accessible to artists and you know, young galleries and public institutions and all the people who can't pay the fees of those other more traditional law firms that I've worked with. And so yeah, I'm very excited about that. And I know we haven't talked much about or at all about various new technologies and the incredibly frothy world of NFTs and things, but there are lots of things at the moment that people are scrabbling around for advice on, and so it's a very exciting time to be focusing on this sector specifically. So that's what I'm doing professionally, and I would love, my dream is through Canvas Art Law to set up something called the Fair Use Unit, where artists can come and visit us. We give a view on whether or not what they're doing is likely to hold up. And then if we say it is, then we stand behind it. And if it becomes challenged, then, you know, we represent that artist and defend their interests as a kind of perhaps as a pro bono initiative. And so that's something that I'm very keen to pursue.
That sounds wonderful.
And in terms of Block 336, so having made the difficult decision that we were not non-essential retail and therefore couldn't open in April, we're opening along with the museums next week. And so next week we have a new show, Karen McLean solo show. It's the usual Block 336 model of giving an artist more time and space to create something beyond their normal studio practice, beyond what's usually possible. So please do go on our website and book a slot for that. I don't know when this will go out, but those are the main things that are going on for me at the moment.
Thank you. Thank you so much. That's all really exciting. And Hugh, can you tell us what you're working on right now?
Yes, there's a few things. I just was trawling through my mind. I had this big show cancelled last year, and I'm still working on that now. Kind of looking for a venue. I was going to do a show with Blaine Southern. Craig Burnett, the director there, just penciled it in to happen. And it was going to be a show whereby my obituary paintings were going to be twinned with originals by those artists. And the originals were going to be supplied by Piano Nobile Gallery because they worked with the secondary market. So we had lined up a Walter Sickert, Francis Bacon, Lucian Freud, all these originals that were going to be paired with my self-portrait based obituary paintings of those people, which would be like my ultimate show. And fortunately or unfortunately, pretty much the day after the show was scheduled at Blaine Southern, the gallery ceased to operate. It was quite dramatic. Anyway, I'm still sort of working on that show. I'm still talking to Craig. I'm still talking to Piano Nobile. We need a venue, anybody out there that would like to host such a show. That's one project. I've got this year is the 20th anniversary of 9/11. I'd been asked to do a solo show by Charlie Smith, my gallery here in London, but actually I've been talking to Gordon Chung and Piers Secunda, and I think we're going to do a three-person show because the three of us for 20 years have followed that story. I don't know if you're familiar with their work, but Gordon sort of followed the oil and Piers followed the war stories, the bullet hole pictures he's done. He's making some paintings out of, he's made ink out of rust from the Twin Tower girders that he's got hold of. It's quite fascinating. And so I'm in dialogue with Piers and Gordon and Charlie Smith Gallery about doing this 20th anniversary show.
That sounds
probably
great.
Here and in New York. We're talking about one of the universities in New York co-hosting the show. So that's another interesting project. And I'm still wading through the 500 years of art history and self-portraits. I've just finished Sue Teen's self-portrait, a second Maria Lasnik. I've got what I'm referring to as my B team, which merges into my C team of all the people. I haven't even done Raphael. I haven't done so many people. They're all in my waiting, in the green room, waiting for their turn. So it's quite busy. I've also made a lot of work on paper, the Artist Support Pledge, a thing called Art Gazette, Papyrophilia, which Xavier put together. So I've got an ongoing paper project going on as well, with working with collage and mixed media and so on. So it's kind of busy.
Yeah,
it's busy in the studio. I'm still teaching.
Busy.
City and Guilds is just reopening its studio, so we're teaching not on Zoom anymore. We're actually going into the studios and seeing real paintings and real students, which is quite thrilling, actually, thank goodness. So we've got last year's degree shows to handle and this year's simultaneously somehow. I don't know how we're going to do it.
Yeah,
anyway, it's busy. It feels busy.
I've been doing some teaching at the Art Academy in Borough.
I know.
I don't know if you know that place. And they've just, I've done a couple of sessions where I've actually gone in person, and it just felt so good to actually be seeing students,
even if it's
life.
Only half, because they've all got masks on.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you so much, both of you, for your time. I've really enjoyed the discussion. It's been really interesting, and I've got lots of thoughts. And I'm going to come to you, John, if I've got any issues with my fair use that come up.
Yeah,
so thank you.
I hope you don't. That's...
No. No, actually.
Just go for a cafe.
Yeah, I'll just go for it. I'll go for it. So thank you. Yeah, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye. Out of Space is a podcast series produced by Space, London's largest artist studios provider. To learn more about the artists taking part and for further resources, please visit the What's On section of Space's website at www.spacestudios.org.